Isaac Skinflint's First Christmas by Kurt A. Perry. Read for you by Sun Sounds volunteer broadcaster Jim Mitchell. Chapter 1. December 23, 1957. The town of Beaverville, born over 100-plus years ago, is a unique rural Wisconsin community. It's a quiet, peaceful, welcoming town, overflowing with scenes exhibiting its spirit of early Americana. The town boasts a population of approximately 2,300 folks, mostly descendants from Germany and Norway. Its isolated location in the north-central part of Wisconsin blessed it as a significant trading destination for that area. Two major state highways, one running north and south, and the other running east and west, intersect, creating the epicenter of the town, referred to as the Four Corners, an active business center for Beaverville. That's the town's only traffic light. The town's roster of businesses lists nearly every type of small business necessary for a trading center. At the J. Skinflint Wood Goods business, Geisick Skinflint was always all business, and his business was greatly successful. Isaac had been harnessed with an early personality in life, and every day at business was alike, cold and lacking gaiety. Isaac Skinflint continued his management style as his father, decades earlier, had deeply ingrained in his mind. Times give birth to change, but Isaac Skinflint was bullheaded and blind, failing to accept change as vital for his company's longevity. He'd never updated some of the outdated management practices from his father's era. Geitzig's father overlooked changes necessary in business to survive. Regardless, the pressure clouds of change were beginning to rain on his outdated management philosophy. There's a single month during each year which Geisick had no warmth for, the annual Christmas season. The date always dropped his already cold attitude even more negatively. The date, December 25th, was when he was born, adding another year to his age. December 25th was also the day his mother had died. He still missed her, and the Christmas season was nonsense. Besides, he made less money during the month than any of the previous 11. That also gave him nothing to celebrate about. From when Geisick inherited the business, his personal and business life rarely varied. It must be 7:50. There goes old man Skinflint in his 1947 Chevrolet on his way to the post office, a couple enjoying their morning routine stroll observed. You'd think that Scrooge-type character with all his money could well afford driving a newer car than that 10-year-old rust bucket, said her partner. One could almost believe the company mail was contaminated with a deadly virus. Skinflint and no one else ever dared touch his mail before he did. So he was the sole individual to pick up the precious mail every morning. This morning, Geisick, as usual, had arrived at the post office before 8 o'clock. He was now frustrated. The time on the large lobby clock said 8:06. And the mail handlers were still working at sorting mail into the many mailboxes covering a section of wall in the post office. Skinflint, with his arms folded against his chest, was thinking, those slowpokes working back there are 6 minutes tardy and still slowly sorting the morning mail. They have no respect for the pressure of an 8 o'clock deadline. He kept his eyes glued on box number one. The sound of metal rubbing against itself filled the otherwise silent lobby of the post office. A postal clerk preparing his counter had opened his station and was ready for the day of selling 3-cent postage stamps and other services.
Sorry, Mr. Skinflint, about being a little behind schedule. Christmas mail time, you know. That's when we get hit with a lot of extra stuff to handle. The sorter'll be done soon, the postal clerk said. It's all out. They're just finishing sorting. And Merry Christmas, the clerk added.
Isaac whispered, his frequently repeated expression in German, meaning nonsense. He quickly removed many envelopes plus general business class mail into a well-used bag. Without speaking or greeting any of the other patrons, also picking up their mail, Isaac hurriedly departed, heading to his office and another new day. That was December 23rd, 1957. Chapter 2. Isaac Skinflint, nearly 20 years ago in his new and large shop, as he referred to the facilities, could ascend the stairs two at a time to reach the second floor offices quicker than a dog chasing a cat. Today, like an old dog, he slowly and cautiously took one step at a time. Entering the main office, he first noticed three individuals working at their assigned desks. Good, he thought. No one looked up or wished him a good morning, or how are you this morning? That kind of repetitive verbal foolishness. They were focused upon doing what he paid them to do, working at their duties. His office and shop was a place of business, not a place for socializing. All of the wooden desks, chairs, tables, filing cabinets, and wastebaskets in the outer office and in Skinflint's office were of the finest workmanship and a quality not to be found anywhere else. They were all made in his shop, with his personal and strict attention to every detail. The royalty style of furniture appeared incongruous in the two dull, unadorned office rooms. Also missing was any evidence or taste of the season. There were not to be seen a Christmas tree or other holiday decorations in either the office or the shop production department. It reflected Mr. Skinflint's wishes. "All that is nonsense," he remarked. When young and growing up, Isaac never once throughout his childhood and during his entire lifetime experienced a traditional Christmas season. His father couldn't accept the time and money being needlessly wasted on fables such as Santa Claus and flying reindeer. The Skinflints never celebrated Isaac's birthday on December 25th, Christmas Day, so the early Skinflint's cold shoulder toward the Christmas season strongly prevailed. Like his father, he'd never accepted the Christmas tradition, as does the rest of the world. Because he never tasted the joys of Christmas, there was a long-time emptiness in him. Such were Skinflint's reasons for the absence of the Christmas season in his office, production shop, and his house. On one wall of Skinflint's office were two temperature-controlled thermostats, and behind his desk, a large glass window. One thermostat controlled the temperature in the office, while the other set the temperature in the shop production area. Both were set to the same temperature, 65 degrees, what he regarded as the best temperature to keep people from getting too warm and sleepy. Also, cool is healthier, Isaac believed. The large window was necessary so he could keep his eyes on the production shop from his second floor desk. His office walls were void of the usual paintings or personal photographs. Only four significant items hung from Isaac's office walls: a large calendar, a map of the United States, a pendulum wall clock he'd custom designed, and an imposing framed flag. The large flag was an Army-Navy E award the company earned during World War II for excellence in wartime production. Removing his coat and fedora, he hung them on a coat tree. Isaac emptied the mailbag onto his long table, pulled up a chair, and began the daily ritual of sorting the mail. From years of opening his mail, Isaac, by quickly glancing at an envelope, could predict what it contained. The most important mail items were the checks. He'd slit open the envelope and glance at the names of the remitter and the amount of the check. The total amount of remittance received that day would establish his disposition throughout the rest of the day. After the morning meeting, he'd hand the checks to his accountant, who would then prepare them for the daily bank deposit. Invoices from suppliers, purchase orders from customers, and other important business mail would be taken care of as necessary. During every Christmas season, the telltale Christmas card envelopes, unopened, were quickly deposited into a wastebasket. Those Christmas cards annoyed Isaac. They were sent from suppliers and others doing business with wooden goods. He frequently remarked, "If they have the time and the money to waste like that, I must be paying them too much." Today, Isaac noted for the first time, a differently appearing envelope, a time he couldn't recall ever seeing before. The return address said, "Internal Revenue Service." "What is all this about now?" he whispered while slitting open the brown envelope. After removing the document, Isaac slowly and carefully read through it. Then he read it again, including the specific portion regarding something he couldn't recall hearing about before. The subject the IRS was inquiring had to do with excessive retained earnings. They wanted to meet at the store in mid-February regarding his case. He again slowly read the IRS letter.
Mr. Pennyworth, will you please come here?
Spencer Pennyworth was his accountant.
Sir, you called?
Within seconds, Spencer Pennyworth was standing in front of Geisig's desk. Pennyworth was tall, thin, well-groomed, and conservatively dressed. He was wearing a black eye patch covering his left eye due to an accident. 20 years ago, he was a shop worker. A splinter of wood had pierced his left eye. As a result, he'd lost his vision in that eye. When Geisig became aware Pennyworth was studying accounting from a Chicago correspondence school, he made him his accountant.
Are you aware, or what do you know about something the IRS refers to as excessive retained earnings? Geisig questioned.
Sir, I'm sorry, but I'm not much familiar. I think it's another tax on businesses which do not pay dividends or that accumulate too much extra cash, Pennyworth slowly said.
Here, read this, Skinflint said, handing the IRS letter to his accountant.
It's serious. Anytime the IRS looks your way, get prepared for the unexpected and the worst. I better call Bert Holmberg and have him fill me in. This doesn't look good.
You're dismissed, Geisig said,
as he waved his hand, indicating it was all right for Pennyworth to return to his desk. Geisig was haunted with the contents of the IRS letter. Since the end of World War II, the company had been debt-free and had accumulated a considerable amount of hard-earned money. It was invested in very secure U.S. government bonds. However, this was one letter he was paying profound, serious attention to.
Chapter 3. I'll never pay people not to work.
The time for the daily morning meeting began precisely at 9 o'clock. It was scheduled for a staff meeting including Roland Berger, the sales manager, Bill Dilly, the shop production boss, Pennyworth, and Miss Lemon. Only Miss Lemon could leave the meeting when it was necessary to answer the telephone. First order of the meeting was when Miss Lemon handed Skinflint an updated daily tally sheet, a summary of yesterday's business activity, bank balance, shipments, new orders, accounts receivable, the payables, and the number of employees on the clock.
One past due. Who is it? Skinflint firmly asked Pennyworth after looking at the report.
$49.11. Baker Brothers and Company. I've talked with them, and they said our last shipment had several packages of clothespins which didn't have 12 in them, so they're holding back payment.
Oh, nonsense, Roland. Take care of it. Let's get paid, Geisig said firmly.
Shipping dollars were low yesterday. How will it be today? He questioned Bill Dilly. Dilly, balding and heavy set, spoke with a loud voice. He started 23 years ago as an apprentice. In time, he'd learned the trade well. Dilly had become an impatient perfectionist with both mentoring and leadership qualities. When Flip Nelson had a heart attack and died, Geisig gave Dilly the job as shop department boss. Only once during those years did Geisig need to use the heavy hand with Dilly. During the war years, the shop was working 9-hour days and 5 hours on Saturday mornings. One Saturday morning at noon, when everyone had left the shop, Dilly entered Geisig's office with a request.
Mr. Skinflint, I was wondering if it would be okay for me to have next Saturday morning off. Do you remember? I mentioned a month ago my daughter Judy was getting married then.
Dilly had been nervous all week about having to remind Geisig about not being available that morning.
Mr. Dilly, if being at your daughter's wedding is more important to you than your position here, then you may take that Saturday and every other Saturday off. Then it'll be up to your new employer.
Bill Dilly's request had quickly changed Geisig's normally cold blue eyes to red. He became so heated up. Bill Dilly, as usual, showed up for work that Saturday morning. The time of the wedding was changed to the afternoon. That was the only occasion when Skinflint needed reminding Dilly his job was number one in his life. Then everything else followed.
You must remember it's the money you earn from your work, which will then provide for your needs, Skinflint frequently was quoted to his employees when referring to the importance of working and earning money.
At the morning meeting, Dilly noted,
the order basket's a little low now. We must slow the shop down as usual for this time of year. Additionally, we have some maintenance work needing to be done to get everything ship-shaped for the new year. There's also one other thing you should know. I've had several people asking if they'll be paid for Christmas Day this year. A couple of the fellows tell me where their wives work, they provide Christmas Day off with pay. That hasn't changed from the past, has it?
No, I will never pay people not to work, Mr. Dilly. You know that. You know better than contaminating my ears with such nonsense. You start paying people not to work, and that'll be the beginning of more problems. Enough of this nonsense talk.
Any time in the past when the topic of paid holiday surfaced, Geizik Skinflint would go into a verbal rage. Whoever he might be excoriating would wish they were in outer space without a spacesuit.
Mr. Dilly,
Geizik firmly spoke, and he reached a small white card laying on his desk. He carried white cards in his shirt pocket, making reminder notes when observing something he didn't want to forget. Geizik continued staring at the shop boss, then said,
Yesterday, at 2:25 for 3 minutes, I observed Bob and Walt, two production workers, who were spending time talking to each other, and not from looking down from my desk.
I could tell they weren't talking about shop duties, because they were both smiling.
That 3 minutes cost me 10 cents, Mr. Dilly. They take care of that. Take care of it now. No more social talking on my time. You know very well I don't like paying workers for not working.
A momentary silence in the room was broken when Ms. Lemon handed Geizik a folder.
What's this folder? He asked.
Like the others in the room, Miss Lemon was a longtime employee of Skinflint's. She lived with her mother in a small, modest home, walking to and from work. She was approaching retirement. Throughout her years, she had been a perfectionist, ever efficient, never missing a single day at her position, and never complaining regarding her pay. Because of her long dedication and contentment, Geizik was planning to offer her the opportunity to continue working rather than retiring.
That's the folder we'd placed requests for donations in if we receive any, she answered.
The manila folder was empty. During the year, Skinflint would have many associations and organizations requesting donations. Each would always receive the same reply from him. Your request is interesting. Kindly send me a request in writing, and then at year's end, depending on my business results, I'll review what I may have available. If any written requests were received, they'd be placed in the folder. Geizik never once received a single written request. He knew and expected no one would reply. That was his polite way of saying no. Geizik was disappointed, though, when he thought back to the past May. The Beaverville Business Association had approached him with an interesting and original request. While his company was a member, he wasn't an active participant, even though they did meet monthly at his favorite restaurant, Der Stein. The Business Association wished to cut Christmas trees this winter from his land and sell them to raise money for their association. They suggested paying him 50 cents per tree, and they would do the cutting. He thought their idea had merit. If they immediately replied, he promised himself he would give them a swift response and make some arrangements. They never replied. Well, no reply, so no Christmas trees, no fundraising, no money, he decided. Typical of volunteers, they lacked steam in their steamroller to keep their ideas rolling. Thinning out the forest through selling trees to the association would have helped his efforts in his continuing yield program and guaranteed a source of trees throughout future years. Isaac Skinflint's approval of such a request would have revealed an exceedingly small crack in his cold attitude towards Christmas. However, what he'd be paid would offset some of his costs towards his reforestation program. Hearing the telephone ringing at her desk, Miss Lemon immediately and quickly left the meeting.
Roland, update us on sales,
Geizik cooled down. His eyes again were blue, and he pointed at Roland.
We've signed up two.
Miss Lemon, returning, interrupted him.
That was the Baker brothers. They found the missing clothespins. They'll be mailing their check today, Miss Lemon said as she returned to her chair.
Good.
Roland, finish giving us your update, Geizik requested.
Looking at Roland awakened Geizik's memory back to a time 20 years ago when he first met a young boy named Roland. Frequently, when Geizik left the post office with the morning mail, he'd see a young boy.
Each time the youngster said, "Good morning, sir," then he'd continue on his way. One morning, on a very cold December day, an incident with the boy occurred. It was so cold that day that when the large clock on the cupola at City Hall announced its time with its musical chimes, they sounded more like the chattering noise from a jackhammer failing to break up a solid block of frozen steel. The boy, with his hands deep in his pockets to warm them, said, "Good morning, sir." At that moment, Gysaac slipped, falling on an ice-covered sidewalk and spilling his mail over the snow-covered area.
"Let me help you get up. Are you all right?" the boy said.
"No, I don't need your help," Gysaac snapped while waving his arms and sending his silent leave-me-alone attitude. Instinctively, the boys did assist him up, and he helped in collecting Gysaac's scattered mail. Then the boy stood with his bare hands returned to his pockets, looking at Gysaac. His clothing was clean, yet faded, with evidence of stitching to repair damage to his well-worn jacket. "Boy, what's your name? Where do you live? Where are you going at this time of day?" Gysaac inquired.
"Sir, my name is Roland Berger. I live on Elm Street, and I'm a senior in high school."
"What time does your school day end?"
"The bell rings at 3.
"If possible, could you be in my office by 3:15? "My name is Gysaac Skinflint. Do you know where the wooden goods office is?"
"Yes, Mr. Skinflint, I can be in your office by then," said the boy.
That day at 3:15, Ms. Lemon, standing in Gysaac's office door, announced, "There's a young boy here wishing to see you. He said his name is Roland Berger. Should I let him in?" Glancing at the wall clock, Gysaac noticed it was 3:15. "Yes, I know him. Send him in." Standing in front of Gysaac's desk, Roland Berger was nervous and felt uncomfortable. "Please tell me, Roland, what does your father do?"
"My father died several years ago. My mom, during the school year, works in the kitchen at the school."
"I need someone to do things around here. Cleaning, helping in the shop, shoveling snow, cutting grass, those types of chores. It's part-time, after school and Saturday mornings. Are you interested?"
"Yes, yes, I'm extremely interested. And, sir, I'll never be late or slack off. Thank you, thank you. When do you wish me to start?"
Roland, overjoyed from anticipation, reflected it in his voice. "Today, right now, I'll have Miss Lemon introduce you and explain your chores," Gysaac said.
"Oh, thank you, Mr. Skinflint. Thank you so much. You made me feel so happy today. Thank you again. Now I'll be able to buy my mother a Christmas present this year."
Gysaac continued watching Roland as he departed the office. He was thinking about Roland never inquiring how much he was going to get paid. Yet he was eager to earn some pay, so he'd be able to buy his mother a Christmas present after receiving his first pay envelope. "I've made him happy, that boy. He's the only one. No one else ever told me I seemed to make them feel happy before." Suddenly, Gysaac realized Christmas Day was before Roland's first paycheck next week. Roland would not be paid until after Christmas. He could hear Miss Lemon talking to Roland. "Miss Lemon, please tell Roland I want to see him again," he called out. Then Gysaac opened a desk drawer, removed a $5 bill from a small money box.
"You want to see me?"
Roland asked. "Yes, you can do good work with cold fingers or frozen hands. I'm advancing $5 now, so you'll be able to buy some gloves and whatever else you need at JCPenney's." He knew a pair of gloves cost less than a dollar. Gysaac also never expected repayment of that advance, and he never requested it. Sitting back in his large chair 20 years ago, Gysaac watched Roland as he headed toward Miss Lemon. "I like him. I believe there's some potential in him. Is it possible that boy could someday be the son I never had?" New customers, one in Arizona, one in New Mexico, both small. Also, I just finished a call with the Accurate Time Company. We'll be getting their contract to supply their wooden clock cases for next year. They'll be our first customer for our new custom products section. Roland had convinced Skinflint the company would diversify into new markets to grow the business. Skinflint approved the idea if they would not need more than 3 additional hourly workers. Roland and Dilly had figured a way to make it work. From Gysaac's momentary daydreaming, he missed Roland's earlier remark. "Roland, anything else?" "Yes, quickly. I'm seeing something of a growing interest. I think it's something we should seriously start researching as an update to our products. It's not entirely new. It's been around for a while. It's called plastic." Then Roland flashed some literature and brochures he'd had that were regards to plastics. And one more comment. This has to do with a new product called the electric clothes dryer. Soon, it's going to take off, and then we'll be seeing fewer eggs in our golden goose, the clothespin. Just something to think about. File that plastic stuff. My clothespins cost less than will one of those electric boxes. People will always buy cheap. Meeting over, Geisa quickly said. He wasn't interested in wasting time on that kind of nonsense. As the others left Mr. Geisick's office, Roland remained. He was the only employee allowed to refer to Mr. Skinflint by his first name. Geisick, there's something Bill touched on, and I feel a need to follow up. You know, I'm out in the shop several times during the day. I'm hearing a message for you that you're not getting. Now I'm going to be the messenger, only because no one else has access to you as I have, Roland said. Now please, hear me out. I want to request that those down there get paid for Christmas Day, Roland said, pointing through the window to the employees working below. No, 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 stop, halt, nine. I'm not going to waste any more time talking about this nonsense. We have more important topics to work on. I will not, I will never, never ever pay people for not working. I realize what you're saying. I understand where you're coming from. Down there in that shop, we have 43 very dedicated, loyal, hardworking employees. They average about 15 years' time working here for you, Roland responded. He continued, yes, you let them have all the usual holidays off without pay. They get no vacation pay, no insurance, and the only way they get a pay raise is when the darn government raises the minimum wage. Now they earn $1 an hour because it was recently raised from 75 cents an hour. All that may have been the way business was run in the 30s, but times have changed. If we're going to see a tomorrow for this company, we must keep up with the times, with today. By the way, there are enough employees for some union to blindside us, Geisick. Please look into this. Soon, Roland was now prepared to hear, you're fired. Instead, Geisick was silent. He had fire in his eyes, which were glued on Roland. Then the verbal dam holding back Geisick's frustration melted. Slamming down his fist hard on his desk, he loudly exploded, 9 unions! I will lock the doors. Then all 50 can go find work elsewhere. Roland, I know you're the messenger. Sometimes the messenger doesn't always bring good news. This is not good news. Yet I know you must keep me informed. I mean what I just said. I will never, ever pay people not to work. And you can take that message back where it's necessary, Geisick now calmly said. Here, read this. Geisick handed Roland the IRS letter. That is profoundly serious. I've called and left a message with Bert Holmberg at his usual $35 an hour to find out what it's all about. I want you to listen in when he calls back. Roland read the letter and after rereading it, handed it back to Geisick. I'm not certain just how this is going to be resolved, Geisick said. The questionable tone in his voice reflected his serious concern about that IRS letter. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Jim Mitchell, reading Geisick Skinflint's First Christmas by Kurt A. Pare. Now, on to Chapter 4, Mariana. Geisick again read the letter from the IRS. Shaking his head in bewilderment, he thought he'd best start a file. He expected there would be more of this kind of stuff forthcoming. Reaching for an empty file folder from a large bottom drawer in his desk, Geisick accidentally removed 2 manila folders which had been stuck together. One was empty, while the other contained a single item, a photograph. It was a long-time missing picture of a young, extremely attractive woman. It was a photograph of Mariana Peterman. Leaning back in his chair, Geisick, perusing the photograph, recalled how beautiful she'd been. Years ago, he'd given up hoping he'd ever find that missing photo. Then, any memories of her gradually faded away. Placing his head against the headrest of his large chair, Geisick closed his eyes. He began a sentimental, daydreaming journey of Mariana and him nearly 45 years ago. At 25, he'd owned the shop since his father had died. One afternoon, a well-dressed gentleman and a young, attractive lady entered the shop. He introduced himself as the Reverend Frederick Peterman, the new minister at the Lutheran Church, and his daughter, Mariana. He quickly visually appraised my shop, and then he informed me he needed a desk for his study in the church. The Reverend, in a soft tone, hinted he'd only had limited funds available. Geisa detected he was hinting to him to donate a desk. Even though a sporadic Catholic, Geisa wasn't about to donate anything to any church. He was going to receive some money from the Reverend, or he wasn't going to get a desk from him. During the Reverend's continuously slow, articulate, and reserved words, Geisa frequently glanced at Mariana. And she also, with her big brown eyes, was scrutinizing each of his movements. The Reverend asked about an unfinished desk sitting off to one side. It happened to be a desk another customer had ordered. However, he'd left town before the shop had finished it. He said that one would be simply perfect. Mariana's presence had weakened Geisek, but not so much that he was going to donate the desk. He mentioned a non-negotiable figure. With a soft tone of reluctance in his voice, the Reverend agreed. After completing the necessary work to finish the desk, the Reverend had Billy's drayage service deliver it. Geisek went along, helping with the delivery and planning to settle the Reverend's count on the spot. Prior to leaving after the delivery, Mrs. Peterman invited Geisek to dinner at a future date. Mariana's parents appeared to be very gracious. He accepted the thoughtful gesture. And in conversation, he learned that before she was born, her father had wanted his daughter to be named Mary. Her mother wanted her favorite name, Anna. They capitulated by naming their daughter Mariana. That's the way Geisek remembered the day it all began for him with one beautiful Miss Mariana Peterman. Greta, Geisek's mother, had cast him in a very meager knowledge into the world of women. She'd been overpowered by Julius, Geisek's father, in his vital preparation for more significant necessity of running a shop to make money. Ergo, Geisek's priorities were always about the shop. That was his onyx excuse when the day of the dinner invitation arrived. His attentions had been occupied, as usual, with the numerous shop duties. At the time he suddenly recalled the invitation, he was already 5 minutes late. Rushing directly, without changing clothes, he arrived covered with sawdust and other shop grime in his hair and his clothing. His lack of respect was embarrassing to the family. Still, that event would establish his pattern for the next several months with Mariana. Geisek was challenged by the relationship as it transformed into a dichotomy of priorities between two loves. Uppermost was his material love of his shop and his money. The other was the uncertainty of being in love. He viewed love as an emotional, potentially momentary feeling, physically untouchable and unpredictable. As time passed, Geisek was certain those heartfelt feelings would most likely wither away like a whiff of smoke, leaving him with a shattered heart and depressing memories. However, his love for prosperity would never fade away or be the source of a shattered heart. Geisek continuously worked, employing every precious minute at his shop. He worked until the very last moment, and occasionally even much longer. He didn't like wasting time getting gussied up, or changing to look impressive in his appearance, or pretending to appear to be someone he wasn't. He'd rather utilize his time changing a rough-cut-looking board of lumber into a wonderful, professionally smooth-appearing finished piece of valuable wood, which he'd sell for money. That was something he loved doing. Also provided bonuses in the feelings of accomplishment and satisfaction. Geisek also lacked the proper etiquette, acquired from experience, which would have guided him to be an eager, fitting gentleman to impress desirable women, especially a beautiful lady like Mariana. Instead, he lacked the mental ability to overcome his addiction to work, the source of which satisfied his material love for money. Still, she truly remained warm and hopeful in his sharing a space in her future life. During the next several months, the couple would be together at least once a week. They became familiar with each other, but maybe not. Now, as he recalled, perhaps she was getting to know him much better than he observed about her. Otherwise, he would have changed. After arising late every time, and even failing to show up a couple of times, Geizik was no longer welcomed for dinner. However, the affair continued casually with Mariana as a couple walking and conversing. Reverend Peterman's scrutiny of Geizik and his unimpressive appearances had left him deeply concerned. He felt uncomfortable about Geizik seeing his young daughter any longer. In a humble, fatherly voice, he counseled Mariana about his concerns for her and Geizik Skinflint. "That young man is the rudest kind of workaholic I've ever known, and he is today what he'll always be, rude and inconsiderate of others. He'll probably work himself into an early grave. Sadly, he'll leave this world without knowing or feeling the warmth, pleasure of experiencing life as a family man. I see him as passing through this time, very lonely person, without true love. I believe, Mariana, it's best for you to seriously consider what Geizik Skinflint offers you, now and in his questionable future. He doesn't even care about cleaning himself up to appear presentable outside of his shop. My dear, Geizik Skinflint is not yet ready to be your world. And besides, he's not a Lutheran, Mariana. Think kindly about my serious concerns about Mr. Geizik Skinflint." The next evening, approaching the large white house Mariana lived in, Geizik noticed she was sitting on the front porch swing. He casually waved a greeting at her as he approached. Mariana expected he'd arrive late, and he was again late at arriving. When Geizik leaned toward Mariana to place a kiss on her cheek, she surprisingly turned her head away from him, displaying her cool feelings. He sat next to her in silence, waiting for her to speak. She sat looking at the opposite direction, not wishing to make eye contact with him. Still avoiding eye contact, Mariana broke the silence. "Geizik, do you know, since we've been seeing each other, how many times you've been late? Even now, today, and including the 3 or 4 times you failed to show up at all?" Now, looking directly at him with her beautiful brown eyes that weren't wide and bright, but instead were dull and reddish evidence, Mariana had been crying. "A few days ago, my father had a serious talk with me regarding a concern he has. It was about you and me. What Father told me was already something I'd been concerned about. It left me with something to think about, and that's what I've been doing." Mariana paused, wiping away tears. "Geizik, you've got beautiful blue eyes and wavy blonde hair, a proud sign of your strong German heritage. I believe below all the sawdust and grime from your shop, you're handsome. But I don't know, because I've never seen you cleaned up, including right now, again today." Looking away, Mariana began wiping her tears again. "You're obsessively good at what you do in your shop, and your work and making money is your only true love. Perhaps money is your god. I hope not. Maybe that's the reason during all the times we've been together, you've never once said you love me. There's only room in your heart for one love, and that's your love for your shop, Geizik. You're not capable of sharing your heart with two loves. That's the real sad foundation for your possessing a single love." Mariana again paused for a moment and then continued. "I'm not expecting anything extraordinary in my future. I only wish to be respected and treated like a lady, to be needed and to be loved by a man who equally desires those same common jewels of love from me. Unfortunately, Geizik, I believe I will not ever once see or revel in such a joyful moment or feeling of love from you during any kind of future we might have together." Mariana, now standing and looking at Geizik, who sat still on the swing, said decisively, "You'll no longer need to leave your shop and rush arriving late to be with me. I'm saying good night and goodbye to you, Geizik Skinflint, for the very last time." Mariana was now sobbing with tears streaming down her cheeks as she opened the front door, entered her home, and slowly and quietly shut the door behind her. Geizik opened his eyes again, looking at the photo of Mariana. He was recalling that sad day, that very moment, over 40 years ago, as if it had only just occurred. As he again relaxed, he shut his eyes. His daydreaming then continued. He sat staring at the door Mariana had now closed. They were separated by a door which symbolized the closing of all doors between them forever. They were each now alone on both sides of their closed door. As he watched her shutting the door, he had a deep, sickening feeling there was never going to be another time he'd ever see Mariana Peterman again. Reluctantly, he bit the bullet to accept the sad reality that this wasn't the time to attempt having any relationship with her or anyone else. His efforts were exclusively going to continue faithfully fulfilling his obligation to his shop. That was the last time Gysak ever saw Mariana. That ended the only time he was ever so involved with such a lady. After a couple of years, he heard a rumor that Pastor Peterman and his family, including Mariana, had moved to a larger congregation in Madison. He never learned whether she ever married or not. Chapter 5. Gysak's Daily Shop Visit. Miss Lemon, standing at Gysak's door, a bit concerned, asked Mr. Skinflint, "Mr. Skinflint, are you okay?" "Yes, what is it?" "Your CPA, Mr. Holmgren, left a message. He wants to get Steve Miller, his partner, involved in his call back to you. He'll be calling you back in a couple of hours."
"Okay, I'll be in the shop," Gysak remarked. He figured Holmberg would add another $35 or $70 to a call for that one.
The day after Gysak moved his desk into a private office from the production shop floor, and every day since, he spent an hour or more observing the activities on the production shop floor. This was where the money was made or lost. With his hands clasped behind his back, Gysak slowly shuffled through the production area. While moving about, his experienced eyes scrutinized as if it were holding a powerful, invisible magnifying glass. He constantly kept searching for additional ways to increase productivity. During the next day's morning meeting, if not sooner, Bill Dilly would come under wrath of Gysak's interrogation for answers. True to his name, when Skinflint walked through the shop, many of his employees would think, "He's so tight that when he walks, you could actually hear his body squeaking." Gysak Skinflint was blessed with a talent to seize monetary value from efficient time management. He was a master at successful transferring, like an alchemy process, the space of production time into precious money. Gysak, when attempting to mentor someone, would frequently repeat his past experiences. J. Skinflint Woodgoods was considerably more successful than any of Gysak's many competitors. Gysak admitted to himself he wasn't any smarter than his business opponents, but he was more successful because he knew he and all his employees needed to work longer, harder hours than did his business rivals. Also, unlike his competitors, he had room in his heart for only one love, a love for J. Skinflint Woodgoods, his cash cow. Gysak noticed Jesse Carpenter working at his desk. Jesse, having labored for Skinflint for over 15 years, was the straw boss responsible for logging, sawmill, and maple syrup operations. Skinflint owned a huge, lush forest area which supplied the wood needed in the manufacture of their wood products. Along with various types of trees were many hundreds of maple trees which supplied the sap for making maple syrup. Jesse suddenly experienced the feeling someone was standing behind him. Quickly turning and looking up, he saw it was Skinflint.
"Is there something I can help you with, Mr. Skinflint?"
Jesse Carpenter was accustomed to the routine of Skinflint's super micro-inquisitive management style. He also never forget Skinflint's policy of requiring restitution for any kind of mistake. It was during the maple syrup harvesting shortly after he started working there when he got his first taste of Skinflint's style of corrective action. The moisture from sap needs to be evaporated in kettles on hot stoves. One unforgettable time he was distracted and failed to remove the sap from the stove, and he ruined a batch. Because of that mistake, Skinflint laid him off for 1 week without pay.
"What are you working on now?" Skinflint inquired. "Double-checking on the supplies we need when we start making syrup. Everything looks in good order for next year."
"Just be sure everything is here and ready, Jesse," Skinflint remarked. Gysak had named the product Beaver River Maple Syrup when he began selling it. Because the supply of maple syrup varied seasonally, it was then generally inconsistently profitable.
Yet, whatever profit it generated helped to offset some of the expense of the more important continued yield of reforestation, a guaranteed Trees for Tomorrow program. A long-sounding ringing from a bell was Ms. Lemon's signal that Geisek had a phone call. Hurriedly heading to his office, he heard Jesse wish him, "Merry Christmas, Mr. Skinflint." "More nonsense," he remarked under his breath. Geisek was always annoyed at that seasonal phrase. "Mr. Holmberg and Mr. Miller are on the phone," Miss Lemon informed Geisek as he entered his office. "Roland, follow me. I want you to listen to this," Geisek requested. Skinflint wasn't one on a business call at $35 or $75 an hour to waste money with small talk, such as the weather in Green Bay or how those Packers were doing, or did. He didn't care. It was serious, 100% all business call.
"Oh, Skinflint here. Roland Berger is sitting across from me. Now, how about that IRS letter I mentioned earlier? What's that all about?" Geisek snapped, immediately getting down to business.
Glancing at the wall clock, he noted the time.
"Well, Geisek, it's something unusual for the IRS to take a look at a small company like yours, except that you're sitting on a huge pile of money. The excess is something referred to as excessive retained earnings. You pay yourself an exceedingly small salary, yet don't pay dividends to the stockholders," Holmberg mentioned.
"You know I'm the only stockholder, and I don't need any more money than the salary I already take."
"How serious is this?" Geisek asked, with a deeply concerned tone. "And Bert, you're my accountant and tax advisor. Why didn't you see this coming before and alert me to it?"
"Geisek, as I said, we don't see it affecting a company your size. Anyway, it's all in the past now. The date on the letter is when the line was drawn in the sand. It'll not change anything, even if you pay any dividends this year," Holmberg stated.
Roland gave Geisek the silent high sign that he wanted to ask a question. "Hold on a minute. Roland has a question for me." Placing his hand over the telephone mouthpiece, Geisek said, "What is it?"
"What if we told the IRS we were reserving those profits for future company expansion, like changing to plastic products or something like that?"
"Just a thought," Roland said. Geisek passed Roland's idea to Holmberg and Miller. A long pause followed. Then Holmberg responded,
"That suggestion's worth some consideration. As a possible solution going forward, we'll also have a suggestion or two. Send me a copy of that letter. We'll get back to you again right after the first of the year. We'll also schedule a trip to Beaverville when the IRS is there in February. Now, I want to give you a heads up, Geisek. There could be some serious interest and penalties facing you. This could be very costly. Anything else now?"
Holmberg remarked.
"Nope, that's more than enough. I'll send you a copy of the IRS letter tomorrow. It's already too late for today's mail."
"Merry Christmas to you all," Holmberg wished.
"Well," Geisek glanced at the wall, "that call lasted 42 minutes. I wonder how much time he'll actually bill me for," he thought. The telephone call didn't give Geisek Skinflint any restful peace of mind. He was upset from what Holmberg had told him and what the consequences apparently were going to cost him. Right now, that IRS letter that the phone call has got me so upset, it's got me feeling sick to my stomach, and it's been an exceptionally long time since anything has given me that feeling, Geisek pounded on his desk, said in a loud, hostile voice.
"Roland, get whatever information you already have on that plastic stuff and start collecting and preparing all the information necessary to prepare for that IRS person. For years, I've paid all the taxes as required, and as you know, my company's done well, and I've saved that extra money. Damn it all, that profit's in U.S. government bonds. They've already got my money. I loaned it to them. Now they want to steal it from me. There's no difference between a robber coming in with a gun loaded with bullets to steal my money and some IRS robber with a paper loaded with legal words seizing my hard-earned and saved rewards." Geisek, sitting in his chair, angrily continued, "Over the years, I've kept buying those bonds for a rainy day when I might need that extra money. But we never had a rainy day. So now the IRS is telling me it'll never rain that hard, and I don't need that money anymore. So they want it."
"All right, Geisek, try to slow down and take it easy," Roland calmly remarked. "Holmberg's a good CPA. Perhaps our suggestion is doable, maybe not, and he'll have something else. You best be prepared for the unexpected. One way or the other, I understand this will not be easy for you to swallow. You'll eventually need to cash in some of those bonds to satisfy the IRS and get them off your back. Now and going forward. Guys, it gets sad, but it's the way things work. That's the way it has to be, and it's going to be. It was after 5 o'clock. Anything else now? Roland asked. Likewise, I'll see you in the morning. Good night, Geysik. Geysik, as usual, would be the last to leave at the end of the day. Looking down into the shop area from his office, he saw a large, now silent, dimly lighted production area. All his 43 employees were finished for the day. He missed the muffled, blended sound of his style of music softly filtering in his office throughout the day. For Geysik, the sounds of music he enjoyed was distinctly unusual. It didn't originate from a gathering of various musical instruments and singers harmonizing or shouting together. A blending of nonsensical noise, sadly implying it was music. That was not music to Geysik's ears. His employees were his musicians. Their instruments were saws, sanders, drill presses, spray guns, metalworking machines, and tools. Each operator was the maestro of his sound. Collectively, the harmonizing from those screeching, wailing, thumping, zipping, hissing, steaming sounds were not only wonderful music being played to his ears, they also were the sound of lovable money being made. Still, standing looking into the shop, Geysik's thoughts were about what kind of a rotten day this had been. The letter from the IRS, plus both Roland and Bill mentioning again about some employees wishing to have December 25th off with pay. Not one of those 43 employees had ever been laid off because of not having enough work. When production orders got busy and he needed more workers, he worked everyone overtime. When production slowed down, they returned to their normal hours. Then the company didn't ever need to hire or lay off. Geysik knew all these employees by their first names, including all their family members' names. Every anniversary of their working at the shop, Geysik personally thanked them for being loyal, and then he presented them with a crisp new $5 bill. Now they also wanted December 25th off and expected to be paid for not working that day. "I will never, ever pay anyone for not working," Geysik slammed his fist down hard on his desk. He put on his coat and his fedora, turned off the lights, and as usual for this time of day, his next stop would be at Der Stein restaurant. After a day like this, he was more than ready for the change of atmosphere he'd welcome in the busy restaurant. Chapter 6. Der Stein. Der Stein restaurant, located in Beaverville's business center, was the best and most patronized restaurant in the area. And Der Stein restaurant was owned by Geysik Skinflint. Skinflint had two motivations leading him into the ardently competitive restaurant business. First, not married, when arriving home at day's end, there wasn't someone waiting for him who'd prepared his meals and cleaned his home. And there was only a couple other small eating places in town, which he referred to as unappetizing, greasy spoon-type restaurants. So for Geysik Skinflint, to satisfy his needs and his taste buds, he opened an authentic German restaurant named Der Stein. The restaurant's architecture and interior decor was 100% true German. A small, raised area with a table and four chairs and a coat tree was located in the far rear of the main dining room. This location was reserved exclusively for Geysik Skinflint. From this higher site, as his second-floor office overseeing the woodshop, at Der Stein he could easily view all of the activities in the kitchen, dining room, and the bar area with his critically eagle eye. Hans Essen from Germany was the restaurant's general manager. Geysik and Hans usually spoke in German to each other, especially when they didn't want their employees to realize what they were talking about. Der Stein was consistently busy, catering to wedding receptions, private parties, civic organizations, noon luncheons, and individuals enjoying dining out. Geysik Skinflint dining out 7 nights a week at his restaurant was their most loyal yet most critical customer. The management technique Skinflint applied at Der Stein closely mirrored his successful wooden goods business. However, the restaurant only provided Geysik a meager profit, a profit so small he was convinced it had never significantly enhanced his craving for money. Nevertheless, it saved Geysik the frustration and cost of a personal cook and housekeeper at his residence. So instead of providing an acceptable profit, Der Stein did at least help pacify one of his many ongoing frustrations. The streets from Skinflint's woodgoods shop, located at the northwestern edge of Beaverville, to Der Stein was a well-worn path. Geisick, when leaving the shop's parking lot, initially traveled through a residential area. He turned right into Huntington Street, the main north-south highway, and then heading south, he traveled through several block-long residential areas. During this time of year, practically every home along the way was adorned with lighted Christmas decorations and ornaments. What nonsense, Geisick thought. And then he repeated out loud to himself, what wasteful nonsense. The cost and time spent on all that momentary glitz was truly an example of the nonsensical use of hard-earned precious money. After reaching Henry Street, the main east-west highway, and the intersection controlling the flow of traffic with stop-and-go lights, Geisick was then only three blocks from Der Stein. Several years ago, he'd approached this intersection at Huntington and Henry, and a car sped through a red light, nearly hitting him. Since then, he's always proceeded cautiously. Tonight, glancing to his left, he spotted a car very rapidly approaching the intersection. Quickly braking, he stopped as the speeding car ran through the red light, only missing him by a dangerously close couple of feet. Isaac pulled into Der Stein's parking lot and was still experiencing haunting thoughts from that near-miss accident. His voice trembling, he said out loud, "Where are those darn policemen when you really need them?" Isaac paused at a beautiful, thick, wooden-crafted door in an elegant lead-glass window, shining the words, "Willkommen zu Der Stein," boldly welcoming in German each and all to the restaurant. This night, as Geisick Skinflint opened that door, he was welcomed by a blast mixed with the sounds of music, laughing, shouting, singing, and the aroma from delightfully prepared foods.